We are happy to be with you this hour on WPKN 89.5 FM. This is What's Happening New Haven. I'm Bonnie Likes with engineer Sean Bigler. And without further ado, I'll let you in on our first New Haven guest. First up, we'll be discussing the New Haven Jazz Underground with Nick DiMaria. This is a grassroots organization dedicated to producing, promoting, and supporting jazz and all of its forms in New Haven, Connecticut. Its founder, Nick DiMaria, is a trumpeter, composer, bandleader, educator, and community activist. Nick has performed across the country in various bands and musical projects, including the New Haven Jazz Festival, Warped Tour, many NYC jazz clubs, and more. His latest release, Mr. Millennial's Revenge, gotta love that title, is a collection of new compositions written for his electric quintet, Wired. New Haven Independent Review writes, quote, Nick DiMaria casts his lot with the jazz of the 1970s. He and his band are a tight, sinuous unit whose music is sometimes moody, sometimes playful, and often danceable, in a word, groovy, end quote. So let's fire up our talk now with Nick. Nick DiMaria, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on with us today.
Hey, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So first, Nick, please tell listeners about the organization you founded, the Jazz Underground, based in New Haven. When did this get started, and what's the driving mission of this collective?
Sure. So the New Haven Jazz Underground was formed in February of 2019, and it's kind of the culmination of where my career in the organizer activist avenue just kind of naturally went. I grew up in the punk and ska scene, so my roots are in that DIY mindset of you know, if you want to perform, you got to make the opportunities yourself. And so starting in 2010, my first official series was the jazz series at the Outer Space, which ran for about 7 years, just until that club closed. And then from there, I was tapped by Jazz Haven, and I served as one of their programming directors for about 3 years, and then parted ways from Jazz Haven and started the Underground. And the mission has always been to create opportunities for musicians to play. I noticed a lot of kind of negative and toxic behavior in the jazz scene. And that's not to criticize anyone specifically, but I always joke that some of the most self-destructive musicians are jazz musicians. We're a little too focused on ourselves, and I just wanted to create an environment where that was broken down, where that ego that goes a little too far was just kind of reeled in, so that people can play and network in like a healthy and vibrant environment.
And the music's only going to get better when you do that. That's so amazing that you shaped and moved that structure and went to something better.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, not to brag, but the proof is in the pudding. But before COVID, our regular jam session was so well attended, was so packed, that it would be a rare occasion if I could get on more than two songs a night, because there were so many musicians coming out to play.
Oh, great.
We did it every other week at Three Sheets on Elm Street. And every, you know, so if you're familiar with that room, it's not that big to begin with. So you're already cozy. You add 20, 30 musicians in there. And it was just, it sounded like a freight train some nights. Uh-huh. And there was never any bad vibes. And that's what I loved about it. And I would just, sometimes I would just get to play one song a session, because I didn't want to hog it, and I wanted to allow the younger musicians especially a chance to thrive. And you would just be surrounded by amazing vibes. And I knew that the mission of the organization was legit and it was working.
Right.
Just based on that. I mean, after 6 months of forming, we produced our own jazz festival.
Right, exactly. So it's not about the individual ego. Now it's about us.
Yeah,
that's Really beautiful. That's so great. So what type of community performances before COVID came upon us, Nick, were generated by the Jazz Underground? How have you shown up in the New Haven community? You mentioned a couple of venues there. Have there been other things like street parties and things like that? Or
so going on? We were, we were just over 2 years. We were just over 1 year old. We were starting our second year when everything was shut down. But before that, we had I think it was something like six series a week. Every week there was six nights we were performing music, basically every night but Saturday.
Wow.
We had jazz going somewhere in New Haven. We had our jam session at Three Sheets. We had Thursday nights at Alto de Florian. We had Sunday mornings at Florian. We had a Monday night series at Cafe Nine. We had there's a seafood restaurant called Mr. Crab. We were having, I think that was Friday nights. We were jam packed all the time. There was always shows. There was always opportunities to play. And again, not that I regulated it, but I wanted to make sure that musicians who I thought deserved the work.
Yes.
Got it. So we were always rotating musicians. One thing I noticed over the years of being a musician is the reason why jam sessions kind of fizzle out is because they tend to be too much about the host band and not about the jam session.
Mm.
So for Three Sheets, for instance, every Tuesday that we had it was a different band. And I made sure that the first hour was dedicated to that leader's music. They could play their own stuff or whatever compositions they wanted to bring and then open it up so that nobody felt uninvited. And I thought that that was a barrier I was kind of breaking that I noticed when I got out of school. I felt, like I was saying earlier, that there was this kind of negative vibe going on. And it was, we talk about vibing in jazz music, and it's the most destructive element in our music. It's the reason why we're still, struggling with a lot of things. And it's and that's simply just the act of not working together. And that's kind of my whole theme, with these series, is that making sure that everybody had a chance to play.
That's spectacular. Really, that is so great.
I used to say, I love New Haven and I love jazz, and I just want to put two and two together.
That's so great. And so now on a more current note that we unfortunately have to touch on, how is the live streaming going? And have you been able to play live recently at all?
So my last gig was March 8th. I was set to play every night the following weekend, but I was sent home from school on March 12th. And then the gig I had that night was canceled. So just like everybody else, hunkered down, kind of tried to try to keep occupied with everything else. As the summer came around, some opportunities came about. I have a working relationship with Yale, where they give basically, they give me work and I disperse it. They give me a series of dates to perform on the street, and some of them are it'll be three places at once. So obviously I can't do that. So I would hire basically members of the underground to fill in those slots. So over the summer, I worked outside for a couple hours. One of my residencies, the wonderful bar in Middletown, Conspiracy, I like to think of them as family. They started having me perform again, I think starting in July, but we were playing out in the patio.
Mm.
So it was really just that. It's outside work, the Yale stuff, that one gig. And then starting tomorrow, actually, my jazz brunch at Alto de Florian will start back up. And that was that gig on March 8th that was canceled. So
fantastic.
Almost my first official post-COVID gig is back there. So I'm really excited to start that back up.
Great. And at the end of our talk, definitely give the specifics on that so our listeners can enjoy hearing about that and attending, hopefully.
Sure.
So does Jazz Underground coalesce with your solo projects but not encompass them per se? I mean, you probably try things out at these performances or get new ideas or perhaps, you know, select certain cuts from your album. Do you you just work with so many different players? Maybe you don't do that. You don't bring your solo stuff in, but do you?
As in, do I perform my own music at these events?
Yes. And promote it and things like that. Yes.
Sure. I want to make sure, I feel like my authenticity will not be questioned as long as I practice what I preach. So I try not to put my own music in the forefront.
That's what I was wondering,
too,
right?
Too yeah. much. Because yeah. I feel like if I say all this like community stuff, but then really it's the Nick DeMaria show all the time, that defeats the purpose.
Yeah, but
it will,
you know,
just make me look...
Sure. But some of that would be all right, I think. I think everybody would
forgive
you for that.
No, yeah. I mean, I do.
Sure.
I make sure, you know, I was hosting the jam session at Three Sheets, you know, whatever week was parallel to my birthday. So I would take that. I played the Florian dates a lot of the time. And I would, you know, I would, depending on the performance, I would bring in original compositions. I try to work as much as possible. So because of that, I'm very lucky to have a large pool of musicians, of really talented musicians to back me up. So it's always nice to have somebody kind of come in, you know, rotate with another player. My main band has been, two of the members have been with me for about 10 years, but you know, I like to try to keep the band personnel a little flexible. It always makes the music more interesting. But you know, you tend to play with your friends, you know,
absolutely.
And you know, and
because you want
gravitate.
That vibe, you want that good vibe.
Yeah, you gravitate towards that vibe.
Sure.
For sure. And then sometimes you like to hire someone who you're not familiar with,
right.
Whether it's because they're someone better than you, or plays a certain way that's different than yours, and you just want to keep challenging yourself. That's something that like jazz musicians do naturally. We always want to challenge ourselves, and sometimes you put a drummer in there that maybe on a different level than you, and you just and you realize how much they can lift you up and make the music better.
That sounds amazing, Nick. That's really great. And I also want to definitely clue listeners into your individual history as a player. You have years of formal education in jazz and music and have toured extensively with all kinds of notable players. In your previous years, you were deep into ska, as you mentioned earlier, with the Flaming Tsunamis, and later played with well-known names like Jeremy Pelt and Wayne Ascoffery and Peter Bernstein and Jimmy Green. But let me ask you, Nick, how did you come to pick up the trumpet the first time? What inspired you to pursue this instrument?
Real quick. I picked it up in fifth grade, like most people do at 9 years old.
Okay.
You know, I first saw, my first memory of the trumpet is seeing the music video to Paul Simon's You Can Call Me Al. And if you recall that video, Chevy Chase is playing the trumpet in it.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, and I didn't know who Chevy Chase was. I just thought it was so cool. So I couldn't wait until band started in school to pick it up. And just a note, like some of those amazing players you've mentioned. My series at the Outer Space allowed me to work with some really great players like the ones you named, Jeremy, Wayne, and Peter, amazing musicians. And I was so happy to book them and get them in as special guests at the Outer Space. So thank
Brilliant.
You for bringing that up.
Absolutely.
Those were good memories.
And it sounds like you have fond memories of school. So now I want to definitely touch on that you're also an educator, and you mentioned that a little earlier too. Does this mean teaching theory in private lessons? How do you show up as a teacher, Nick?
So I live this dual life. By day, I'm a public school kindergarten through eighth grade general music teacher. I don't, you know, nothing fancy. Past primary school theory, primary school music. And then at night, I play, you know, I put on the cape and cowl and attempt to be a jazz musician. And I came across that because when I was in school, in college, there was no, there were no, you know, guarantees. And there were, as you know, I'm not saying that there are now, but I realized I liked teaching. And I realized that if I had a job that provided me some stability, I could pursue the art that I wanted to do without worrying about paying the bills. And that's a big influence from my mentor, Dr. Eddie Henderson. So if your listeners are unfamiliar with him, he got his big break in Herbie Hancock's band. His first trumpet lesson was from Louis Armstrong. Miles Davis was a friend of his parents. I can go on and on about Eddie, but real quick, one thing that made Eddie really influential on me was he was a practicing psychiatrist during the day and played at night. And he used to tell me, you know, it allows me to make sure the bills are paid and then I could take the gigs I want. And that really, really drove home for me. And I was like, and I decided to follow a similar path. So I just realized that education was just kind of something I really enjoyed doing. And I've been doing it. This is my 13th year. So that's what I do by day. And then I perform, you know, at night. And I, you know, it's a nice balance. What's great is that I get to do music during the day with the kids, but it's a little different than the music I pursue on my own. And then it's nice to, you know, just have that stability. So that's really why.
And I dare say it's leaked out into the Jazz Underground mission, because you're collaborating, you're setting up a more, if you will, educational environment for everyone who participates. So being an educator just plays right into it. Sounds like you got some very good life advice there. And Nick, it reads in more than one spot in articles on what's been related about you that you're very inspired by Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock indeed, and the 70s vibe in general. How might these influences present themselves in your own playing and composing, perhaps especially for your most recent release, Mr. Millennial's Revenge? How did those fantastic players show up in your own compositions?
Well, it's hard to be a jazz trumpet player and not love Miles Davis. Just what he was doing in the various points of his career, you know, I could spend the whole show talking about that. But one of his eras that really, really just pulled me in was what he was doing in the late 60s and early 70s, where he was adding rock and funk music to his own. And he was writing these tunes that were very open, but they were kind of based on grooves. You know, Bitches Brew, Live Evil, Live at the Fillmore, all kinds of those records, In a Silent Way. And that stuff, when I was first learning jazz, like that stuff was more accessible to me. So I think it just kind of got into my DNA. And Herbie was a member of Miles's band. And Herbie, I love. My favorite compositions are always Herbie's. And I just kept digging into both players. And I discovered a band that Herbie had after he had left Miles Davis, called the Wandishi Band. And they recorded three albums, and it was very much in this funk, open, free jazz kind of vibe. And it turns out Eddie Henderson was the trumpet player in Wandishi. So I ended up meeting Eddie just after I discovered this band. It's very serendipitous, actually. And when I met him, all I wanted to do was talk about his time in Mwandishi, and he did, and he's been my teacher since 2003 from that first conversation. But to answer your question, my music is very much influenced by Miles, by Herbie. Mr. Millennial's Revenge is a culmination of a lot of Herbie Hancock's influence on my playing. I feel like at this point, it's now kind of one of the main sources of influence when I decided to start composing again. I just want to replicate that sound just in my own way. And the title just comes from, you know, with the state of the current political realm we live in.
Yeah.
I'm 37.
Yes.
And I'm a millennial. And I remember when I was told I was a millennial, I was in ninth grade social studies, and I read this, they had us read this Time article about the millennial generation,
the kids
that were going to be adults in the internet generation, and, you know, ooh, the internet, right? And so as time went on and it became very apparent that people didn't know what millennials were, it just became this slur.
Yes.
For anyone younger, you know, for any young person, basically.
Right.
And so I noticed a lot of people my age kind of saying, oh, I don't identify as a millennial. And the whole title of the album is basically like, no, man, like this is our generation. This is who we are. And don't run away from the hand we were dealt.
I think, own it. Yeah, own it.
I think millennials have done a great job considering, you know, we graduated college, we're dropped into a, you know, the recession and everything going on in the mid 2000s, and we're still here, you know, and we're going to be here for a little bit longer. So
absolutely.
I think there's like this sense of pride, and it's kind of like a, you know, a little sarcasm dipped in and that's where the title came from.
That's
more
great.
We got to take this term back. It's not as dirty as you think it is.
Well, there's different ways that millennials are kind of categorized too. But I love the title of the album. I love that kind of animated pizzazz it's got. It's great. But so, Nick, I think I noticed a quote from you. I think it was back in 2016 that you'd been experimenting and free playing solo trumpet. And it's been a minute since then. Maybe describe how this style is put forth in the context of an arrangement. And is this type of execution still inspiring you behind the trumpet?
So I'm totally an audiophile, and I will listen to a Miles Davis bebop tune from the early 50s. And then the very next tune, I'm listening to someone like Nate Woolley or Joe Morris or Leo Smith or Taylor Hobinum. And the approach that those gentlemen have to their instruments is so fascinating.
Mm.
I haven't been able to pursue the solo playing that I want to. And I was actually hoping that during the COVID era, with a little more free time, I could put some tracks down. But the idea of just throwing everything, all the rules out the window, and just make a piece of art with my instrument, I think it's just fascinating. And I think in the last 2 years, maybe I've done two solo performances. I know one was at Never Ending Books, maybe last year. It's a whole style of playing that deserves its own attention. So unfortunately, I don't pursue it as much as I want. But funny enough, one of the musicians I named Nate Woolley, he's a trumpet player too, who does a lot of experimental playing solo. I was able to have a Skype lesson with him back in the spring and really picked his brain about approaches he's done. So hopefully down the line, now that I've gotten some equipment shipped to the house, I can start laying stuff down in my office.
That sounds fantastic. Nick DeMaria, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. And as we wrap up this segment, is there anything you'd like to shout out to listeners? Website, Facebook info, dates on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. So very quickly, even though the Jazz Underground is really just me, I always talk about it as we, and that's because I've had so many people help me out with various things. So I just real quick, I want to shout out to my man, Alec Rice.
Please
check him out on Spotify. He is a producer. He is a jazz vibraphone player. He's a great kid. And he's been helping me with this Mind the Hang concert series we had. He's the nuts and bolts. And I couldn't do anything that I've done this summer without him. So Alec, check him out, Alec Rice. He's got a couple of tracks on Spotify. And everyone else there's a lot of people to name. So there, you know, anyone else who's been helpful in booking, producing or being interactive with the Jazz Underground. Thank you. Dates coming up. We're going to wind down as the fall comes around. We're winding down the My and the Hang series, but we will have either one or two performances a month. I myself will be performing at Conspiracy in Middletown on Thursday. I believe that's the 17th. We're celebrating women's suffrage, so we're playing music by women composers in jazz. Tomorrow at Atelier Florian at 11:30, that's for the jazz standards and jazz standard lovers. And just check out all the hits. So facebook.com/NHVJU. We are the Underground. Underground is also a crowdfunded organization. All of our events are crowdfunded. So if you're interested, you can become a sponsor at patreon.com/NHVJU. $2 a month comes right out of your account. You don't even know it's gone, and it fuels the things we do. And then, of course, Nick DeMaria Music on Instagram, Facebook, the internet. And you could check out all the things I've got there.
Nick, thanks so much. Thank you so much for helping the jazz scene stay vital and alive in Connecticut and bringing more joy and collaboration to the process. I get a sense that you will do this wherever you go. And we really appreciate you coming on What's Happening New Haven today. Thanks for joining us.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Nick DeMaria with the cut Wonder Cat from Mr. Millennial's Revenge. If you're just hopping on board, you are among friends here at WPKN 89.5 FM. This is What's Happening New Haven. I'm Bonnie Likes here with engineer Sean Bigler, and we have yet another exceptional musician with us this hour. This next guest was cued to take the stage at Cafe 9 this month of October, but instead, for reasons known to us all, he's tucked away in his home in Australia. If you don't know who he is, allow me to school you with the following review of Bob Logg III. This is from The Guardian. Quote, "Should you never have had the joy of seeing Bob Logg III play, let me attempt to describe it for you. Picture a man in a shiny blue jumpsuit and a pilot's helmet, wired to a telephone receiver, playing slide guitar with all the dirty, scuzzy joy in his heart. Add to that a kick drum and a foot cymbal, the myth of a monkey paw in place of a right hand, and you'll begin to get the gist. It is loud and strange and electrifying, and how ecstatic it all sounds, that guitar glazed with a kind of sublime and honey-dipped happiness." End quote. An irresistible review of Bob Logg III from The Guardian. And before Sean fetches our phone call to Australia, he'll fire up a quick taste of Bob Logg III. This is Move It Wrong. That's our second guest coming up this hour, Bob Logg III, on fire there with a tasty cut titled Move It Wrong. And having placed a call to his bunker in Australia, let's welcome him from out under the down under to the show now. Bob Logg III, you are in Australia. Welcome to What's Happening New Haven.
Hello, Bonnie. Hello, New Haven. It's me, Bob Log III.
Right on. Well, it is a thrill for us to dial your number from the Northeast U.S., but we want to check in with you first about the current thing we're all in these days. How is COVID affecting Australia right now, Bob?
Well, we've been in, I'm in Melbourne, which is in the state of Victoria, which has been in a hard lockdown for about, I guess it's getting on 8 weeks now. So we're not supposed to go 3 miles from our house. If you're found without a mask on outside, you get a $1,000 ticket. What else can't you do? There's a curfew at 8 p.m., so I'm not on tour, so I don't go out much late at night anymore. But the other day, I dropped my daughter off back at her mama's house, and then I went to the shop to buy some groceries, and they're like, ladies and gentlemen, it's 7:30. You got to get home.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, my God, I forgot. You know, I've never lived in a place where there's a 8 o'clock curfew. So it's taken very seriously here. And at the same time, you know, they freak out if they have 100 new cases, which is nothing, you know, compared to the 40,000 or so that's happening in the States right now.
Right.
So it's a very different experience down here, but people are still getting it, but it's, and they've just now lightened the curfew and everything a little bit. So now you can stay out till 9, and I think we're allowed to drive 5 miles from our house at this point.
No kidding, man. That sounds
pretty crazy.
Tight. Wow.
So I can't even go to Sydney. If I was going to try to go to Sydney right now, I would be put into 2 week quarantine. Or if I tried to sneak into Sydney, which one lady just did, she tried to sneak into Perth and they caught her and she's going to jail for 6 months.
Oh, no. Oh,
yeah, it's
no.
Crazy.
Oh, wow.
So wow. Here's just everybody stay home. Everybody stay home. Don't leave your house, which is hard for a person who's used to touring 6 months a year and playing guitar all over the world. But yeah, I've figured out ways to make it all right. And I guess we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yes, indeed. For sure. Yeah, that would be really rough on a musician who's used to having an expansive lifestyle, for sure. So, Bob, before we
musicians are pretty much locked down everywhere. I don't think there's any clubs anywhere in the world, really. There's a few places where bands are playing again, but it's very limited.
Right.
So, yeah, all tours are canceled. Musicians got to stay home.
Yeah.
And even if they're going to open up some sporting events in Australia in the next month or so, musicians are not. That's not on the table yet. So, yeah.
Right.
Most dangerous profession in the world is being a live band, apparently.
I dare say. So on a happier note, Bob, before we get into your background, I'd love to talk about your helmet. And for those of you out there just joining us, Bob Log III performs I would describe your music as kind of like high-octane blues, guitar and vocal. And you wear a full-coverage helmet that totally wraps around your head, leaving your facial features, Bob, kind of a great mystery. But I want to ask you, how was it or what was it that made you strap on your first helmet start performing?
Well, the helmet happened kind of by accident originally. I ride a motorcycle. And I was on tour with my two-person band called Do-Rag. And we were in Lawrence, Kansas. And sometimes when you got a couple hours off on tour, you end up going to a thrift store, which is great tradition in Tucson and everywhere else, I suppose. Anyway, I saw this sparkly silver motorcycle helmet, and I said, that'll be perfect for my trike. so I bought the helmet. And then that day, basically, my drummer left the tour, decided to go back home to Tucson when there was still a show that night, and we were opening for Ween, this band called Ween, which is
love Ween.
Band.
Ween is great.
Yeah, fantastic band. And I decided this was like the third time this had happened, where suddenly tour was canceled. I guess I'm going home. And I was like, wait a minute, I don't want to go home. I want to play guitar tonight. What do I got in the car? And I looked around my car, and I had my guitar case. I had my guitar. I had my telephone I normally sing into and this helmet with the bubble mask I just bought the day before. So I was like, all right, I'll put the helmet on my head and kick my guitar case and suddenly I'm going to be drumming. I had never drummed before. So this was, and the show was in about 8 hours. So I had to call Ween and say, hey, Mickey, Thermos just jumped on a Greyhound bus back to Tucson, but I'll show up at the show tonight in Chicago and I'll kick a guitar case with a helmet on my head.
Awesome.
And Mickey, wow. Mickey was quiet for a second, and then he went, he just said, okay.
Okay, whatever you say, Bob Log the Third.
Yeah. Right. So I drove to Chicago, pulling over every hour, trying to figure out, like, I would think of a song, then I'd pull over on the side of the road, sit down and kick my guitar case while I played the guitar part. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. And then I'd pull over and try to do this other thing. But nope, I can't do that one yet. And it evolved. But then that show, I played that show that night, and it went absolutely gangbangers. Everybody went crazy. And then every day after that, I just got a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better at playing drums and guitar at the same time, which is, you know, pretty much everybody, when you play guitar, you might tap your foot or something. Mm-hmm. I just have very loud things I tap on. So it's kind of like I'm tap dancing in a stool, but every tap I do is a giant sound, because it's connected to either a kick drum or a kick cymbal or a hand clap triggered thing or a super giant bass drum kick sound. So, yeah, I'm basically drumming with no hands. You ever heard of that band Def Leppard?
Of course.
Yeah, so the drummer for Def Leppard, he lost his arm. He lost his arm in a car accident.
Right.
I'm like the drummer from Def Leppard that lost both his arms in a car accident. So I only drum with my feet while I finger pick with my guitar, and then I sing through the telephone that's attached to my motorcycle helmet.
Amazing, amazing. Hey, but I bet it must be kind of challenging to perform for long periods inside the helmet. But you've probably constructed some sort of ventilation so you can breathe capriciously. Is that right?
People say that. You know, I try to keep all electronics away from my head. So an air conditioning system or something wouldn't really fly. It does get very sweaty in there, but it is just a motorcycle helmet. There air comes up through the bottom. Like, it's not sealed. My head isn't sealed off. I've got,
right, okay.
You know, it's a motorcycle helmet. So
yes,
air comes up from the bottom. But here's the thing for me. I grew up loving AC/DC. That's what made me want to play guitar when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, playing guitar means you have to sweat your face off, like Angus did. And so everything I do is to try to make me sweat as much as Angus. So the helmet helps with that. This tight suit helps with that. Having people sit on me helps with that. But even still, all the stuff I do, I still don't think I'm even 20% to sweating as much as Angus.
Well, is that sort of a ritual tribute, if you will?
The what now?
The sweating. Is it kind of a ritual tribute to Angus?
Yeah. Well, it's when music takes you over so much that you don't know where you are and you're sweating your face off, and maybe you don't feel the cutting your leg from your legs being jammed through a stage hole. that's what music's for. And the thing about being a one-man band is, when you're playing drums and guitar and singing at the same time, there's this place musicians go when the music takes over and there's no past, there's no future. You're only in the now. I know boxers get there because, you know, boxers can't be thinking about balancing the checkbook when they're boxing. They are thinking about right now. Same with probably race car drivers, maybe stunt pilots or whatever. But musicians get there too. And music can get you to this place where there's no past or future. You are in the song at the absolute moment. So when you're playing guitar and drums and singing at the same time, especially with a helmet on your head, you get to that moment instantly, the first note of the first song, bam, you are there.
Wow.
There's no building to it. You are there instantly, which I don't know about other musicians, but from this musician's standpoint, that's exactly where you want to be.
So it sounds like the helmet is like instant zone, if you will.
The helmet helps, but it's really the multiple things I'm doing at once.
Yes.
So it's where your brain goes when you are doing three different things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really be thinking about anything else. You're constantly in the moment because you have to do something with your foot, your other foot, both your hands and your face at the same time. But the helmet does help. But I do think that if I wasn't wearing the helmet, I would still instantly be in that spot just from doing the multitasking that I'm doing while I play a song.
Got you, because it's just so absorbing and completely enveloping. So about your music, Bob.
And the helmet does protect me because people do get drunk and crazy, and occasionally I get attacked.
Ah.
And it's not in a bad attacking way. It's usually, you know, someone jumps on stage and wants to at my head and kiss it or sit on me or
right.
just fall on me or whatever. So I do get, I don't want to say attacked, accosted.
Objectified?
Well, a little bit of that, but, you know, I am a musician on stage. That's kind of the point. But
that's true.
It does protect me from flying projectiles and crazy drunk people's teeth.
For sure. So, yeah. And not to mention the fact it may not make a bad mask before that curfew happens when you're at the grocery store.
I haven't worn it into a grocery store to buy my bread here in Australia yet, but I probably could because people do have the face shield thing. It's really no different than that. And technically, if singing is part of the problem, like we heard about with that church choir where everybody got sick, they were all
right.
singing in that tight room.
Right.
My helmet would stop any flow of air particles heading toward anybody else.
So, to be sure.
Maybe so, Bob, I am the safest band on earth at this point.
Right. So let's talk about your music. You really play some serious hard-driving blues. What were the influences that propelled you to bust out with that type of sound?
Well, like I said, when I was 11, I fell in love with AC/DC, and that's just, you know, you take the blues and turn it into a party, and that's kind of not correct anyway, because there are a lot of old blues songs that are a party. Like, if you listen to Old Sun House, you know, it's not about sitting down quiet in a bar and singing sad songs. I'm sure some of those songs had people jumping up on tables and kicking over everybody's drinks. but rock and roll just takes the blues and turns it into a party, and I'm kind of done the same thing to an exponentially louder, crazier degree. But yeah, it's just rock and roll. You take the blues and turn it into a party. And so when I fell in love with AC/DC, I was reading about what they liked, and then they liked Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. So then you go back to, well, that's where the blues originally got turned into a party, or at least more of a party. And then you find out about the people that they liked and the weirdos that are all around those ones. And you get into Hazel Atkins, all kinds of ways to make guitar one of the happiest sounding things on earth. And that's how I approach the guitar. I don't do sad songs. I don't do ballads. I'm taking the guitar and making it ridiculously fun to the point where people are smiling so much that their face hurts.
That's great. So
that's the plan.
Yes. And you teach guitar too. Tell us about that. And also Bob Log, please tell us about actually when you did pick up your first guitar. Was it when you were 11 years old listening to AC/DC or before that?
I probably was playing a little bit before that. There was a guitar laying around my house growing up, just an old like Spanish classical guitar that I would just mess around with and have fun with. But no, it was when I heard AC/DC where I was like, that's what I want to do.
Right.
I want to make some ridiculously fun sounds on guitar. And my grandma Betty Lou bought me a guitar from a pawn shop, or a tiny little amp, a PV Backstage Plus. I don't know if anybody out there listening plays guitar, but they're just these dirty little amps that never break, and I still have it. Yeah, and just then you could just sit at home and make noise first, of course, because it takes a while to get good at an instrument, you know. But eventually, and then I went further back and I found Mississippi Fred McDowell, who plays in open tuning and doesn't really use a pick. He uses finger picks or just his fingers. And once I was about 15 is when I put the pick down and started to play with just my fingers. And what that opens up is a whole nother can of worms, where instead of sounding like one guitar, you sound like two guitars. And the party level goes up an enormous amount. And so what I did was learn Mississippi Fred McDowell, his style, but I learned it wrong. So it's not it's not correct Mississippi Fred McDowell. It's kind of its own thing. And that's why I started doing lessons, because I play drums differently than everybody else. I sing through a helmet differently than everybody else, but I also play guitar differently than most people. And it's a technique that's incredibly fun to do once you get the swing of it, and how to make your hands play one thing that sounds like two things. I don't know how else to put it in words. It's really hard to describe music with words. You know, it's like trying to describe a painting. Unless you see it, you don't know what it is. And it's the same with music. Unless you hear it, you don't know what it is.
Can you double up your voice too, Bob? Do you double up your voice in some way?
No, I cannot throat sing. I'm not a throat singer yet. A Mongolian throat singer. No, I'd love to be able to do that. I just do one voice through a telephone in a helmet. That's about the extent of my singing.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
But I will get people to sing along with me.
Yeah, did you install the phone apparatus attached to the helmet that you sing through? Did you, like, invent that?
Yes, I did. So at first, the first night I did this, you know, I didn't know what I was doing yet. So I just duct taped the phone into the helmet on the inside.
Mm.
But then I realized, you know, if I put a hole in the mask, I can fit the helmet through the hole. I mean, fit the phone through the hole in the bubble mask, and that will not only look better, but I'll have more room in the helmet, because the phone was just smashing into my teeth. So I went to the hardware store and found a drill bit for a doorknob hole. You know, if you're going to make a doorknob hole in a door, mm-hmm. it's a specific size hole.
Yes.
And there's this one drill bit that does that. And I looked at it, and I'm like, that looks pretty close. So I drilled the doorknob size hole out of my bubble mask helmet. And then when I put the phone in there, it was like the phone person and the doorknob person were roommates. It's the exact same hole. I couldn't believe it. I'd have to adjust a little here there. It's the eggs. You almost don't even need glue. The doorknob size hole is so perfect for an old phone. It just blew my mind.
Wow. It
and
sounds
so, yeah,
like it was meant to be.
That's how I make the hole in my bubble mask.
Yeah, meant to
What's
be.
That?
It sounds like it was meant to be.
Yeah,
like,
meant to be.
It was in the stars. That's so great. So Bob, I meant to ask you too. By the way, if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Bob Logg III, blues guitar vocal extraordinaire, always wears a helmet when he performs, and kind of a jumpsuit outfit, sort of like a space suit, right? Evil, like Evel Knievel,
yeah.
Sean was saying. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. It's something to look at. I didn't invent dressing up when you get on stage.
No.
I'm just one of the ones to do that. But if you're going to sit on stage all alone in front of a room full of people, you may as well be something to look at.
Yeah. Bob, how did
no
you...
No reason to be shy.
Yeah. Why are you in Australia, by the way, before we move on? How did you get from Tucson to Australia?
Well, I got married and had a baby, and since then I've never left my daughter's side.
That'll do it.
So when I'm not on tour, I'm here with my daughter, who's now 13.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm a dad, full-time dad.
Gotcha. That's so cool. So now, Bob Logg III, please tell us about this service you render having to do with birthday songs. What is this all about?
Well, it's a lot of fun. I'll tell you that for sure. So I've done this before where I was making individual songs for people where they could buy a song for their boyfriend or girlfriend or a song for their pet to help their pet or boyfriend or girlfriend dance or feel good about themselves. I was like, I like this idea of, I guess in the 60s and 70s, there was this company called MSR, and you could send in lyrics and then they would take your lyrics and turn it into a song. And the idea of having a song come to you in the mail that you didn't know what it was. So all these musicians are sitting in the studio, then they'd get the mail and someone would have a song about the color yellow, or I can't say some of these because they're, and then there's another one where, anyway, they didn't know what the song was going to be until something came in the mail. And I wanted to do that. So I did an album called Bumper Meow, where I was singing songs to people's boyfriends or girlfriends or their pet. To try to get them to dance. And then I was like, well, I can just, now that I'm stuck at home in quarantine here, I can apply this same type of songwriting to people for birthdays. So say someone's boyfriend or girlfriend or son or daughter will write to me, and they have to give me a list of things the person likes and a list of things the person doesn't like. and then a bunch of pictures that I can manipulate because I've turned it into a video. And you get a song with the most ridiculous lyrics. Like one will be pancakes, corn, and bighorn sheep. Ready, go. And then another one. Oh, this is a good one.
That's
pork,
great.
Pork, death, and rocks. That pork, death, and rocks is one of my favorites that came out of all this. This guy was a geologist who had a dead elk in his front yard and also likes to cook pork. So I get these ridiculous emails with a ridiculous list of likes and not likes. And then I make a song using only the words that they give me, cramming them into different guitar parts that I come up with on that day. And by the end of the day, I've got this ridiculous song for one person for the birthday. And then I turn it into a video where it'll be like them having the picnic with Albert Einstein or riding on the back of David Lee Roth in a rodeo and send them back a video with an original song that's just for them with their name and face all over it. And I've done almost 200 of these at this point. You can see them all on Instagram page or on YouTube. You just type blah, blah, birthday songs. They're all over the place.
Wow, that is amazing. That sounds like a super bunch of fun. So, Bob, to wrap things...
It is so fun. And it's like, yeah. I say, I wake up and I don't know what's going to happen. And then I get this email and I have to write a song that, about somebody who likes noodles, water slides and noodles.
Of course.
And then there you go. That sounds like a song to me.
That's great. All the ones you mentioned there really do have a certain ring to it. Bob, unfortunately, you know, this is kind of an unfortunate, it's a time-intensive program. There's no other way to say it. And so we kind of have to wrap things up. But what I'd like you to do is give a shout out, anything you'd like to say to Cafe 9 and the city of New Haven. And also please tell people where they can get your music and check up on your touring when it does start again, and maybe get a custom written birthday song or guitar lesson from you. How can people do that?
Fantastic. The best way is to email me directly. It's boblog111@yahoo.com. But if you look up on Facebook or on Instagram or on YouTube, all my videos, the birthday videos are there, and they right in the description tells you how to contact me to order one for yourself. And Cafe 9 is one of my favorite clubs in the world. On my live record I did, oh boy, about maybe 8-9 years ago, Bob Log Surprise, which is available on Bandcamp and iTunes and all that. Half of that live record is at Cafe 9 because
wow.
It just sounded so good. It's like I had these festivals I played at, and I had all these recordings and fancy schmancy huge clubs, but the Cafe 9 one is so ridiculous that more than half the live songs on my live record are from Cafe 9 because I just love you guys.
That is so awesome. That is wonderful. Bob Log III, thank you so much for being with us. It is thrilling and a pleasure to talk to you as we've chatted in vastly different time zones. Thanks for doing what you do, and your fans in New Haven will be really glad when you're back on stage in Helmet once again.
Right on, Bonnie. I'll be happy to be there, too.
Okay.
See you all soon.
Okay, thanks, Bob Log III. It was a pleasure to touch base with both our musical guests this hour, Nick DiMaria with his New Haven's Jazz Underground, and Bob Log III, presently in Australia, queued to hit the boards at New Haven's Cafe 9. Originally, we thank you for tuning in this hour, and we hope you're enjoying a wonderful entrance into the delicious fall season. We'll be with you next month on the very first Monday at high noon, and we recommend stay on board here with your good buds at WPKN for more great programming ahead. Till we talk again, take care.